This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
Two of the interview we started last week, and I really wasn't sure if it was going to go into a two-parter or not, but obviously it did. We're going to be talking more with Carl Lehrberger about his book Secrets of Ancient America, and we get into a little more detail than we did last week. Last week we kind of covered the general picture. Here we go into details on some sites and some evidence supporting the idea that others were here before Columbus, interacting with Native Americans in North, Central, and South America. So, without any further ado, here's the second part of the interview with Carl Lehrberger. All right, welcome back, Carl.
It's great to be back, Soraya, and speaking with Where Did the Road Go? Radio listeners.
And again, for anyone who missed it last week, your book is Secrets of Ancient America, Archaeoastronomy and the Legacy of the Phoenicians, Celts, and Other Forgotten Explorers. And this is available pretty much everywhere.
Well, it's available at my newhistoryofamerica.com website, where there's a little more information on the book and my background and the new history of America. So I encourage people to go to www.newhistoryofamerica.com, and there's a link on the site to Amazon, and they can purchase the book right there.
Does it come in ebook format as well?
It does.
Okay, awesome. You got a lot of pictures in here too.
It was quite a task for the publisher. I think there's 360 of them, so it was most of them are photographs that I took. But I each chapter features a researcher, and being such a vast topic, New History of America, I had to include many other graphics that really help tell the story.
Yeah, and I like how on some of them you show the, you know, you take a picture of a inscription, and then under it you kind of outline the inscription so it's easier to see.
Well, most of the archaeoastronomy and petroglyphs are very, very old, and without that kind of enhancement, nobody would be able to see it. There's a specific, site in California that I talk about in the book, Mojave North. And it is a very old site. And when one shows up midday at the site, they would look around and they wouldn't see anything. And it's because the sun washes out the petroglyphs. But as in the morning, as the sun is on the near the horizon, and in the evening, you have that daylighting where the angle of the sun will hit the panel so that you can see the inscriptions. And that's really part of being at the right place at the right time. Because if you're not there at the right time, you don't even know you're looking at a petroglyph.
Wow. But let's actually talk about Mojave North a little bit. Where exactly is this located? It's in California, right?
It's on the eastern side of the Sierras. I do not disclose the location. I talk about Mojave North in the context of trans-Pacific contact with the New World. And this is a particular site that is very esoteric in many respects, but it also is a significant archaeoastronomy site. And archaeoastronomy takes archaeology, which is mostly looking down and looking for artifacts, and integrates the astronomy. So all of the ancients incorporated the celestial bodies and the celestial movements into their culture. And much of the rock art in North America involves the astronomy of the ancients. And this is one reason why I believe that the story of the new history of America that includes travelers from both the Atlantic and the Pacific has been lost to us because we have, up to this point, because we have not been able to understand how they thought and their language. So many of the ancient sites, both Native American and the ancestors to the Native Americans, as well as foreigners from abroad, incorporated archaeoastronomy not into their buildings and major monolithic structures, as we talked about previously with America's Stonehenge, but they incorporated it into their petroglyphs. And many of the petroglyphs at Mojave North are very specific to celestial days of the year that were important ritual events for the ancients. And what makes Mojave North, I think, unique in North America and perhaps the world is that this very small, compact site, less than an acre, has over 13 archaeoastronomical alignments that are not limited to the equinox, which is the most common occurrence of these archaeoastronomical alignments, but they occur on the solstices as well, which is the longest day of the year and the shortest day of the year. And remarkably, they occur on what we call cross-quarter days. And these are the points between the equinoxes and the solstices celebrated by the ancients. An example would be what we call today is May Day, which occurs around May 1st. But in ancient times in Europe, it was known as Beltane, celebrating the sun god Bel. So in a cross-quarter day alignment, would involve being at that site, either at the sunrise or the sunset, looking at the panel and seeing what the sun and the shadow interplay on the petroglyphs does. And remarkably, when you do have these intentional archaeoastronomical alignments, they tell a story. And one of the most important stories that is told at Mojave North has to do with the on the day of the equinox, a light serpent that forms on the rock, moves across the panel, and its open jaws of this light dagger or light serpent engulf a oval petroglyph in the middle of four concentric circles. So it's a target, but what you see is this light serpent moving across the panel and engulfing this oval egg or sun or circular object. Now, what's remarkable about this, in addition to just the aesthetics and the dynamics of being at the site and seeing this light dagger move over a period of about 45 minutes across this rock and specifically hit a target, where the day before and the day after it's going to be off, and if you were to go a week later, it wouldn't even be close, is that this particular motif, a serpent swallowing a disc or an egg, is replicated throughout North America in large earthworks, the most famous one being the giant serpent mound. And that same motif of in a very monumental architectural a format of a large serpent engulfing and swallowing an oval, having it in his mouth, is replicated at the Mojave North site in a petroglyphic light show, where you can actually see the serpent going across and engulfing the oval, and we would like to refer to it as an egg, perhaps. So this is but one of 13 alignments that has been documented and that colleagues of mine and myself have discovered. And they are not limited to equinoxes and solstices and cross-quarter days, which makes this one of the most unique sites in the world, but it also includes lunar alignments. So this particular site is in terrible need of protection, and it is on public land, but the public archaeologists have refused to acknowledge its importance. They don't consider the archaeoastronomical aspects of it to be important enough to even protect this site. One day I was there, and a family was picnicking, and the little boy, he's about 8 years old, he had a rock, and he was throwing it at one of these panels. And again, midday, you can't see there's rock art there. It's all washed out. No signs, no protection. Now, as I've written about the site, I emphasize the archaeoastronomical aspects, both for the archaeological community and the Native American community, because nearby Native Americans claim it as theirs or their ancestors, which I dispute. And the archaeologists see nothing important about it. They consider it a typical Great Basin petroglyph site. So to take out the controversy of origins, myself and others have, diffusionists have determined that this is not Native American, nor ancestors of the Native Americans, but these were, petroglyphs were created by a Pacific culture from Greater Indus Valley. So when I do talk about it, I really want to emphasize that this is should be a World Heritage Site just on the basis of the archaeoastronomical alignments that occur there on all of the celestial days, including lunar alignments. But it does represent, I think, one of the more significant sites that do document a trans-Pacific culture. And we see this in numerous different petroglyphs, and there is some epigraphy or written script there that has not been adequately determined. So while we have scores and scores of archaeologists and graduate students combing sites that are pretty well known in California and throughout the West, you will not find any significant archaeological studies addressing Mojave North or addressing the archaeoastronomy of Mojave North or the controversial aspects of the origins of Mojave North. So what I hope to get out of the book is enough, I'd say, airtime that would get people interested in donating to helping to protect this site. The government archaeologists are concerned both about the money and bringing attention to it. On the latter point, I do agree with them that we don't want people going to these sites unless they're fully protected. And until that happens, the best information you're going to find on Mojave North is going to be in my book, Secrets of Ancient America. And I'm hopeful that with enough support, both from the archaeological community, diffusionists, and the public, that we're going to be able to protect this incredible part of our heritage. And in conclusion to talking about Mojave North, I want to just make sure that our listeners understand when I say that it's not protected. It's literally at the edge of a gravel pit. It has got blasting damage from decades of mining at the site and nearby. It's been washed clean by torrential floods. So it literally is on the edge of a mine. And we really need to emphasize the protection of these ancient and, allow me to say, sacred sites, because what is revealed are the sacred cosmologies and, in many cases, the prayers and the imagery of the ancient religions at these sites.
Now, is part of the problem that archaeologists just don't look at the archaeoastronomy aspect of these sites?
Well, that is a significant problem, but we have to ask ourselves why they don't even show up at these sites. And, you know, this is one of the real challenges that we face, and a question, the obvious question is, why doesn't the public know about this? And taking it one step further, why do traditional archaeologists continue to deny the validity of this type of archaeoastronomical research and diffusion in general? And I think part of it is that we have at work a conspiracy to reinforce the old paradigm. Things like American exceptionalism, manifest destiny, are things that are so ingrained in our culture, as well as the whitewashing of American history with the ridiculous notion that the Europeans discovered America, when in fact there were Native Americans and Native American civilizations here when the Europeans arrived. But more importantly, there were millennium of a history over here, and advanced culture in many cases more advanced than the Europeans. So one of the problems is there's just a conspiracy to reinforce the old paradigm and to continue with the conquest had its benefits. I would also like to believe that in this rock art we see esoteric traditions, not only of the Native Americans, but the non-Native cultures as well. And when we start getting into old world cultures, for example, in Europe, the Mithraic religion that is so well documented at the Anubis Caves in Oklahoma, which we may have a chance to talk about a little later, as well as images of Bel and Celtic gods like Sheila Nagig, and I would argue in California, images of Shiva. This is something that really is of traditional archaeology, and we really need a much broader circle of experts and academians to interpret what's being shown to us. At the end of the day, I would say that Alan Watts got it right. Right, and that the reason that the archaeologists are kind of upholding the great lie is that it's reinforcing what Alan calls the taboo against knowing who you are, and so there's a little bit of that when the knowledge is spread around. It's not only in the hands of the archaeopriest. So we've been in a movement of dumbing down. I would call an aspect of de-evolution. And to reveal a new history of America is an evolutionary thing, and this is something that I think is a threat to the traditional archaeological community. Because what is left when one examines the evidence of the Celts at America's Stonehenge in New Hampshire, and later day old Irish travelers that made it to Kentucky and Tennessee, as well as probably Gaelic speakers that made it to Oklahoma, it becomes apparent that the history in the history books is wrong, and that the professors and academians that teach it are teaching misinformation. And nobody wants to admit that they were wrong. So I think that's really getting at the heart of not wanting, of the academians and the archaeopriesthood, not wanting to admit that they've been wrong all these years.
Now, you talk about the possible influence of India on this site. Did India have the means of crossing the Pacific?
Well, that's the great question. And the answer is yes. Unlike Columbus, who had his three little ships, the people from Greater Indus Valley had ships that held hundreds of people. They could have carried elephants to the New World to carry out their labor. And one just has to go back to the history books of India, as well as the sculptures, to see the different type of sailing vessels and different type of ships that they had. And even in Marco Polo's journals, he describes later days Indian ships as being elegantly dressed out with gold and silver, and they were luxury liners, and they carried hundreds and hundreds of people. So they clearly did have the shipping, but not only the shipping technology, they had the navigation skills as well, and the mining skills and mineralogy. So when they came to North America or South America looking for gold and silver and copper, they knew exactly what they were going for, and in many cases they knew exactly where they were going to get it. So they had these, not only the shipping skills and the ships, but the knowledge to get here and back using the currents at different times of the year, and to undertake the mining on a vast commercial scale.
Wow.
This is there's a book by Gene Madlock, who has since passed away, called India Once Ruled America. And in the book, Mr. Madlock provides ample evidence that the people from India had made it to the New World, had integrated somewhat with the natives. And as a result of that, what remains is some of their culture in both the art, in the dress, in the language, and in the case that I'm citing with Mojave North, some of the cosmology that they left in stone. So that's an excellent source about the Indus Valley cultures to the New World. And I would say that Gunnar Thompson's book, American Discovery, not only talking about India, but talking about China and Asian influence in the New World with a focus on Central America, is critical reading for understanding that the Trans-Pacific cultures made it to America over really thousands of years, including South America, Central America, and North America.
Okay. And let's get into a little bit of Central and South America. There does seem to be some... Actually, I had one more question on the Mojave North. The inscriptions and stuff there, are they distinctly different from the traditional Native American stuff you find around it?
Yes. Okay. I would say that the... Which is, you know, one reason why the site was... is described as a Native American, and what the archaeologists called a typical Great Basin site, is that on one of the panels they have three of the sheep with the big antlers, if you will, the big horns, and this is very typical of the a Native American and ancestry that you find in the Great Basin. And based on those three petroglyphs, they called it a typical Great Basin site. However, a careful examination of the petroglyphs, if you can find them and see them, will show that they are not typical Great Basin at all, and quite the contrary, have different images and are quite a bit older than what you usually find. And we can tell that by how worn these petroglyphs are. So there's a lot hidden in these messages that are provided by the ancients. And Mojave North is really one of the best sites to see it. I would say, though, that the several potential epigraphic writing there has yet to be determined. We have diffusionists saying different things, and this is another reason why it's important to get the archaeological community's head turned around so that they could come to this site without fear of being lambasted by their colleagues and get their expertise to look at some of the epigraphy that is yet to be interpreted adequately, and which will reveal, I think, a lot about the origins. And just as importantly, getting professional archaeoastronomers and archaeologists looking at this site with the different perspective of the astronomy of the site. And with those two things, Mojave North is really going to prove in the future to be one of the most important old world sites in the new world.
If we can get it preserved.
Yes, and the history is just disappearing in front of our eyes, and it's just the saddest thing to go to these sites and see the damage that's been caused not only in the past but in the present. And this is one reason why archaeologists would rather keep these sites quiet. Nobody know about them. Nobody go there. No signs. And they see that as probably the best way to protect them. Without disagreeing with that, generally, I do disagree specifically with this site, because I've been told by several archaeologists that in the area there are tens of thousands of petroglyph sites, and by the area I mean the Great Basin. And, you know, we can't protect them all, says the government archaeologist. And I think there's some truth to that. But there are a handful of sites, scores of sites, that are not just mainstream sites, that are worthy of protection and worthy of doing research for regarding the new history of America. And that's why this is one of them. And it's not on the basis that I make that statement that it's an old world site because of the controversy of that statement, but it's on the basis of the elaborate and extensive archaeoastronomy that will provide so many clues to its origins.
Okay. Now, if we look at Central America in particular, I remember David Hatcher Childress writing in one of his Lost Cities books that he was in a museum in China, and I think he said if he didn't know where he was, certain aspects of that museum, he would think he was in Central America.
Well, this is, I cited before Gunnar Thompson, whose book, America Discovery, is one of the better books on diffusionism in the New World. But Dr. Thompson completed an extensive study of the symbols from Asia that have found their way into the New World. And it's not just like 5 or 10, there's scores of symbols from Asia that are just almost carbon copies of what you will find in China, that you'll find in Central America. And I think in our previous interview, I talked about the swastika from India that we do find in the Great Basin. But in Central America, we see a greater, I'd say, Asian influence in some of these symbols. For example, the serpent with a face of a man is just one of dozens of different symbols that we find in Central America, and they occur at a very specific time of 200 BC, right up to about 200 AD, and then the influence kind of wanes. And this is, I think, very indicative that the area of Central America was not just contacted by the Asians with the remaining symbols that we see there, but it was probably in contact with Pacific cultures and Atlantic cultures as well. An example of that, of course, is the Olmec civilization that has left these giant colossal heads that are very similar in looks to African heads. And it's just very striking that we see this on the east coast of Mexico. So on the east coast, we see some transatlantic influences. On the west coast, we see Asian influences coming in, but then they stopped. So Mayan and other Central American tribes, you know, developed their own art based on the earlier Mayan art forms. So we also have many other similarities with the Asian cultures including jade and the use of jade and how precious jade was, and the techniques used to cut jade as well are very similar. So in addition to symbols and the value of jade as ceremonial art, and even how the jade was worked, we see these very good cases for diffusionism. Now, Central America, I think, makes the case that diffusionism goes two ways. Not only do we have cultures from Asia and greater Indus Valley and Europe coming to the Americas mostly for mining, I would surmise, but also for political reasons to escape turmoil. But we see these influences that have been left here in the Americas from all, both the Pacific and the Atlantic. And we see it in the languages of some specific tribes. We see it in the racial makeup of some specific tribes. And we certainly see it in the art and in the symbols.
Okay. And it starts at a very specific point, too, which I think is really significant. You have a completely different style of art before a certain Central America. And then suddenly it takes on the look and similarity to Asian art all at once. It's not like one symbol does. It's a lot of stuff very suddenly taking on that form.
That's right. And, you know, Thompson, although he did years and years of research, and he even went to China, I believe, to corroborate his research, they would not, the university that he was seeking to publish his dissertation on this, they wouldn't publish it. And his attempts to get tenure throughout his career have been unsuccessful. And this is really about the gatekeepers at the universities, the gatekeepers at the Smithsonian, National Geographic, really preventing scholarly work in diffusionism from getting into the mainstream. And I'd highly recommend Gunnar Thompson as a great source, not only for talking about diffusionism in general, but specifically talking about the symbols that arrived from Asia in Central America and Mexico.
You also got to wonder if the Spanish hadn't destroyed all of the books and so much other stuff in Central America, we might have a essentially the evidence right there in front of us without any doubt that China was communicating with Central America.
Yes, and you know, you bring up the point that in the conquering of the Americas, part of the tactic of the Spanish and the Portuguese was to completely wipe out the libraries of the South American and the Central American and Mexican cultures. These were not just little scrolls, but these were vast records and libraries on astronomy and cosmology and religion and medicine, literature, timekeeping, and perhaps hundreds of thousands of scrolls from Central America and Mexico. Only three survived. So, you know, you make a great point, and this was part of the work of the conquistadors, is to erase this culture. So the fact that we even have these fragments, we have to cherish and protect and really take the time to understand it and put it in a much broader context of diffusionism, as well as these some of the Native American groups having their own culture and their own art forms. But we do believe that we see these influences throughout the Americas.
All right, let's talk a little bit about the Anubis cave and the connections to Mithras.
Well, we're going back and forth between transatlantic and trans-Pacific travel. To put it in somewhat of a context, the Mojave North site, I would estimate to be 3,000 to 4,000 years old from a Pacific origin. and we do see a influences of Shiva at this particular site. Now, 2,000 miles away in the Oklahoma Panhandle, we have a site referred to as the Anubis Caves that apparently is a Celtic site about 2,000 years old. And the group of Celts that came to the Oklahoma Panhandle probably from New England following the river systems. However, they could have just as easily made it to the mouth of the Mississippi River and gone up the Mississippi to the Arkansas. So we don't know if they came from the Gulf of Mexico up the Mississippi or if they came from greater New England, where their stronghold was, and came down the Mississippi to the Arkansas. However, they found their way into the Arkansas and from there into the probably the Cimarron River and into a series of sandstone caves. There's seven of them. And the Anubis Caves is known as an equinox sunset site. Nearly all of the light shows and archaeoastronomical phenomena that take place at Anubis Caves is at sundown on the equinox. And we find at Anubis Caves many indications of a Celtic culture. Among them, we find the petroglyphs of Old World Celtic gods and goddesses. Specifically, we see an image of a Sheila na Gaeilge, which is a very famous goddess, a fertility goddess from Ireland and Europe. And there are still many examples of Sheila na Gaeilge's very specific petroglyph throughout Europe. We find a Sheila na Gaeilge at Anubis Caves, what's the most remarkable thing about Anubis Caves is that it was created by apparently Celts who were familiar with or believers in the sun god Mithras. And the sun god Mithras, right up until Roman times, was the predominant sun god in Europe. And Mithras was no longer celebrated much after the Romans, but we have probably the most sophisticated Mithraic cultural residues that have been left to us in the world in Oklahoma, not in Europe, but in Europe. In Oklahoma. In Europe, these Mithraeans and much of the culture was destroyed by the church, but in Oklahoma we see in archaeoastronomical light shows the story of the sun god. As the sun sets, the shadow falls over the sun god, Mithras or Perseus or perhaps Hercules, while the petroglyph of the dog glyph or the jackal glyph, Anubis, is illuminated. So we have the symbol as the sun goes down of the god of night, Anubis, now in light, and the sun god in dark as the sun now goes under the earth and Anubis now rules the sky, the god of night. So this is played out in a very sophisticated, what my mentor calls a silent opera, as you see the sun moving toward the horizon, the sun god goes into shadow, and Mithras and the dog god, jackal god, Anubis is enlightened. So this is probably the most dramatic light show we have, but we also have calendar counts, but most importantly, we have inscriptions in Gaelic. And this is writing that can be read in a Celtic language. And this is so important because it's not just a phrase like we have at nearby Crack Cave that is a sunrise on the equinox alignment that reads, the sun strikes here on the day of Bel. It's a relatively short phrase, and it coincides with the sun striking the panel at a very specific point on equinox sunrise. At Anubis Cave, it's not limited to a phrase, but we have inscriptions that really tell a story of the worship of Bel and the significance of the equinox in many, many different phrases. So this site is important because of its different archaeoastronomical alignments, telling messages accompanied by inscriptions that can be read in the Celtic language that is describing the light shows taking place. For example, an inscription would read, you know, equal the days, equal nights. You know, it's not a phrase that on this day we have equal days and equal nights. And it's below a petroglyph that's showing a balance of the equal day and the equal night. And below that you have 12 lines. And this particular alignment, the sun strikes the 12 lines in such a way so that 6 lines are in light and 6 lines are in darkness. And with the accompanying phrase in the Celtic language, it really makes almost a slam dunk 100% case that, yes, these were Celts that are describing and writing a cosmological, something important to them on the equinox, accompanied by a light show. So we have numerous inscriptions and numerous light shows at Anubis Cave. And what's somewhat, you know, surprising is that my mentors, Phil Leonard and Bill McGlone, they were able to convince CBS to come to the site, and they brought a whole camera crew out there, and they were able to get perfect photographs and videos of these alignments, because quite often we show up and it's cloudy, you know, you miss it. Mm-hmm. But the film crew came, and it was aired twice on national TV and put in a pretty positive light, and nice. That it didn't go anywhere.
Of course not.
It just didn't go anywhere. And even though many people were exposed to it, and if one were to, you know, Google Anubis Caves, they'd come up with a lot of information. If one were to probably go to Wikipedia, it would not present the case that I'm making. It's because of the overarching archaeological bias against diffusionism. And even though the book that I've written, Secrets of Ancient America, focuses at least 4 chapters on the Celts, because I think that the Celtic expansion into the Americas and the evidence they left make for proof that if one were to go to Anubis Cave, go to a Crack Cave, go to the Sun Temple, which is a cross-quarter day site in Colorado featuring an archaeoastronomical alignment accompanied by Celtic writing in the stones, that it's really 100% proof that they were here, and that it's documented in the stones. And while the archaeologists will say there is no evidence, what can be more better evidence than carvings in stone accompanied by archaeoastronomical phenomena? But yeah, the truth is that when the archaeopriest and the archaeologists say there is no evidence, they're either ignorant or they're lying. Because there's abundance of evidence in the New World that old world travelers and old world colonizers made it to the New World and left artifacts here, including hundreds and hundreds of coins, including sculptures. And, you know, I feature in the book a description of what's called the Crespi Collection, that was from South America, and it was gathered and put together by Father Carlo Crespi. And we find Phoenician art in gold plates that were left and documented, and in a Phoenician type writing. Now, because they were gold, and because nobody gave them much credibility, we don't have any of these artifacts anymore. Only the photographs and the descriptions of eyewitnesses. But this is part of the challenge of the new history of America, and you made reference to it, Soraya, that the history really disappears as quickly as it is uncovered. And I'll just leave this point by saying on one of the chapters I ended on talking about the Celts and their writing systems, a specific site that I had visited in Colorado called the Central Colorado Ogham site, Ogham referring to the Celtic language. And one day I show up at this series of caves that has really well-formed inscriptions, some of them that can be read by epigraphers. And the whole site had been covered up. Literally, they backfilled the site. And nobody would ever know that's one of perhaps 20 or 25 major inscriptions by Celts in America covered up. And if people want to see those photographs before and after of the cover-up, it's in the book, Secrets of Ancient America.
Yeah, it's a literal cover-up. Sounds like you're about to get hit by a train.
Yes. Well, small-town America, we always have the trains going through. I can't help that.
So Anubis is not a Celtic deity. How come it's called the Anubis Cave?
Well, that's a great question. And what we find is that we find a multicultural influence at both. Anubis Caves, as well as the Mojave North site. And this, when you think about it, makes sense that you know, we think of crews of mariners being of one culture, but in the old world, in the Mediterranean areas, you had crews that were made from many cultures and many different parts of the Mediterranean region. So it wasn't just the Celts, but they had other cultures. But also there was a much more of a synthesis that took place in the ancient world, so that Anubis was part of, even though it was an Egyptian deity, it still was part of the Mithraic cosmology. So there was influences coming both from the different crews and different members of the crews that had knowledge, as well as an intermingling of the different cultures on a religious level of Mithraism. What's so interesting about the story of the Mithraic temple in Anubis Cave, in the earlier description of the California site known as Mojave North, is that we see many similarities, even though they're several thousand miles apart, and were created at least 1,000 years apart. And this makes perfect sense, because when you get into the Roman god Mithras, he was came from Persia as Mithraeus. But before Mithraeus was in Persia, he was Mitra, M-I-T-R-A, from India. So you have Mitra going to Persia as Mithraeus, going into Europe as Mithras, finding its way over to America. And in America, with these two sites of Mojave North in California that has a Trans-Pacific influence, and the Mithraic artifacts in Oklahoma, known as Anubis Cave, coming across the Atlantic, we can see in these two sites many, many similarities of the sun god imagery, and specifically the importance of the equinox as these rituals. So the answer to the question is that it's not like like we have today so much that you have like these pure religions, but there was really much more of a confluence of different cultures and different imagery that suited the population in different parts of the old world.
And one of the things you touch on, but you can't, you don't really, you've made this book very grounded. You've only talked about stuff you could actually, you know, support with evidence. But one of the things you talked about briefly are the Egyptian finds in the Grand Canyon that no one's been able to substantiate because they closed off that portion of the Grand Canyon.
Yes, and there's numerous sites that like this that you can find significant information from the literature. In the case of the Egyptians' runes in the Grand Canyon, were documented by a series of newspaper articles. To this day, you cannot get into that part of the Grand Canyon. The Smithsonian denies ever having been there. And again, we have a significant cover-up with anything that really is substantially challenging the old paradigm. And you know, it's for this reason that at the end of the book, Secrets of Ancient America, that one of the things that I call for is really the opening up of these records and that have been hidden by institutions, universities, institutions like the Smithsonian that really have not leveled with the public and have not presented anything other than what suits them. So, you know, in going through the new history of America and trying to show evidence, you can't help but list many of the cases where evidence has been covered up or disguised, and that's just one of several, although one of the more famous ones that appears in the literature, that Egyptian relics had been discovered by archaeologists in the Grand Canyon, but there's no follow-up or no evidence to find. And until the Smithsonian and these institutions open up their libraries and the universities and the museums really open up these artifacts, most of us are going to remain in the dark.
And the area there, a lot of the area of that part of the Grand Canyon actually has Egyptian names to the areas, don't they?
Well, I'm not familiar with that, but it certainly wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, it's just I've been told as well that if you even try to go up into that area, they're right on top of you.
Oh yeah, it's all closed off, and they deny it on, and you just got to wonder why.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. What's their stated reason for closing that area off?
Well, again, I think it's to the point that we're really involved in a cover-up, that the archaeo-priesthood does not want to admit that they were wrong in some instances, and that there's a bias, you know, against diffusionist research in the archaeological field. I would come back to the point that I made earlier, that there's esoteric as wisdom of the ancients that are available to moderns, but because of the taboo against knowing who you are and the need for the archaeo-priesthood to maintain their position and not willing to admit that mistakes were made, they are still holding the banner. Columbus discovered America, and that perhaps Vikings may have made it here, but as far as the multicultural story of discovery of America told by authors Barry Fell, Gunnar Thompson, Gene Madlock, Bill McGlone, and many, many others, they are completely discounted, and the diffusionist scholars are marginalized.
So let's get into a little bit about the Hopewell Mound culture. Now, this was a huge culture right down the center of the United States.
Well, the mound building culture is extensive. There's tens of thousands of mounds, and you know, many researchers have sought to make a connection between old world cultures and the mound building culture. And I would say pretty much unsuccessfully. Part of the problem in making the connection has been the many, many hoaxes that occur in the Midwest that have been documented, and in some cases, researchers have claimed to be digging tablets out of these mounds that have old world inscriptions on them. I did travel to several museums and talked to many people, and really concluded that most of the artifacts that are claimed to be old world artifacts coming out of the mounds that would prove a old world connection, I found to be hoaxes. I really did. And I would also acknowledge that most of the mounds were probably done by the mound builders themselves. Just like nearly all petroglyphs that we find in North America, nearly all of them were done by Native Americans or ancestors to the Native Americans. However, just like in the case of the petroglyphs, where you do find old world petroglyphs, albeit, you know, several scores perhaps, not several tens of thousands, the same, I think, is true of the mound building culture. And one of the more significant artifacts that has been revealed, the Bat Creek Stone, was taken from a mound by a Smithsonian archaeologist. And when they published the inscription, they said it was a Cherokee inscription. But other diffusionist scholars looked at it and they said, no, that's not Cherokee. The artifact is upside down, and if you look at it this way, it's a proto-Hebrew inscription reading the Star of David. So, you know, there is evidence that in some of these mounds that there is old world artifacts. Most of them have disappeared, and most of what is presented as old world artifacts coming from the mounds that I've examined are not legitimate. We need to remember that one of the reasons that the ancients came to the New World is for the riches, the gold, the silver, and the copper. And the greatest source of copper and the purest source of copper in the world is from Michigan. That ancients have been mining the copper deposits on the Michigan Peninsula for thousands and thousands of years. And the Mississippi River provides a corridor, if you will, not only to get there, but to, once the metal is in ships, to sail down the Mississippi with it and into the Gulf and back across to Europe. So we have at the terminus of the Mississippi, one of the most extensive mound building sites known as Poverty Point. And it's a gigantic site. Most of it has been destroyed, and it's a circular site and very unique. And the point that I'm making is that in going back and trying to pull out the threads of leads of evidence that would show a connection to the old world, it's very difficult to do. But it's my belief that in spite of all the hoaxes and the fake artifacts that have been revealed as fakes, that there are legitimate artifacts that demonstrate a contact with old world peoples in the mound building culture. And we, as to kind of bring that full circle, we have the story of the serpent at the Serpent Mound Earthworks swallowing that disc. And that is a symbol that we find throughout North America. And perhaps, as I note in the book, perhaps one of the earliest instances of it comes from Mojave North, where we see the light show. Or perhaps it was a representation of what was already here. But I do think there is a connection, but us diffusionists Indigenous scholars and archaeologists in general really have to go to the next level to document it.
Now, I remember reading an article saying that they were able to trace a lot of the Michigan copper to artifacts in Europe and the Old World, kind of supporting the idea that that's where the copper went.
That's correct, and the copper coming from Michigan, you could almost say, fueled the Bronze Age, and because of science, we can now, you know, determine the source of many of the Bronze Age artifacts that we find throughout the world, and some of them have been conclusively traced to the Michigan copper.
Now, one of the things that often gets associated with the mound-building culture are the stories of giants, which you said you did write a chapter for, but decided to not put it in the book.
Well, we have such a challenge in maintaining credibility so that when we go out to universities and archaeologists and ethnologists and anthropologists, the credibility is the most important thing that we're going to have in our toolbox to get them to listen to us. And while there is a tremendous amount of documentation in the literature worldwide of giants in the rock art, and even going back to the Bible, I did not come up with the smoking gun. I looked for the giant bones. I looked for the skeletons. And I just thought it would not enhance the story of trying to make the case for this old world contact with the new world by including the chapter on giants and other areas of the new history of America, which, you know, you've probably heard in with some of your guests, Zariah, of you know, the aliens and the contact with humans. So sure. I had to sidestep all of that to try to deliver a book that made the case based on facts, evidence, and not only my work but other authors, and leaving aside the stories and the cases, for example, of giants that I couldn't make. And the good news about that is that it leaves me another book to write once we get some evidence.
Right. And I think the thing with giants is it's a matter of time before someone comes up with actual evidence for it.
Yes.
It's just someone just needs to dig up one of those skeletons and then we can work with something.
Well, it's not just this conversation, but you know, you go through the literature and the TV shows and even I think American Unearth, I think a very worthwhile a series on the History Channel, produced by Scott Walter, had an episode looking for giants, and they came up empty too. But just like myself, Scott Walter in his series, you know, presents many episodes. Including an episode on Anubis Cave, by the way, does document old world travelers in the new world. And people like Scott and his research on the Newport Tower, on the Kensington Runestone, are just some of the major topics that he deals with over many, many episodes of documenting a new history of America. Highly recommended for the audience.
All right. Well, again, the book is Secrets of Ancient America, Archaeoastronomy and the Legacy of the Phoenicians, Celts, and Other Forgotten Explorers. This is about 400 pages. It's a decent-sized book. I mean, you pack a lot of information into here. And how many pictures did you say were actually?
It was 360.
Wow. It is really kind of an epic read, and it is, as I said earlier, it's very grounded. You're not throwing out rampant speculation. You're pointing to the evidence. You're showing pictures of the evidence. You're supporting why this, you know, supports the idea that these weren't all Native American inscriptions and sites, and some of them belong to other cultures.
Yes, thank you. And, you know, for the audience whose members that want to find out more, please visit my newhistoryofamerica.com website. And I'd sure like to hear from you if any in the audience know of any sites or, you know, want to share something about their personal stories regarding the new history of America. I'd love to hear from them at www.newhistoryofamerica.com.
All right. Thank you so much, Carl.
Okay, Zariah. It's been fun, and good journeys to you.
It's my restlessness that brings me here again. Each time I'll come out a little farther. The family's used to it by now, I suppose. And Grandma stopped her teasing. Sure, when I was younger, with all that talk of the boogeyman, but who could blame a five-year-old with all the dried gourds and that creaky windmill? I guess it didn't do anything but make me want to come out and see for myself. It's just so looming. For miles and miles. You know I've covered every square inch of this place at some point or another. Yeah, and over there behind that tree line is the Crawford's Pond. It's just that as that sun goes down behind those trees, it's like a change comes over everything. And during harvest and into winter, each night I'll excuse myself from the table, throw on my jacket, and head out into the middle of this field. And with each step, I'll recall the things Grandma used to say to herself when she was working in the garden or maybe putting us kids to bed. It didn't make much sense at the time. She'd say, nine times will the cats play, and after that they'll have gone away. Bear the watcher and the sage. Dark as night when moon glow, come the smell of fall I know, mine the specter and the sage. Used to sound creepy, but now I know what she meant. And maybe now she knows the mystery.